Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Chris Jackson. And we are both, I suppose, talking about how we are still continually amazed about how many inquiries we get both through Ascendo and professionally about the basics, the fundamentals, the simplest questions that need the simplest answers, and how prevalent those lines of inquiry are in spite of all the so-called sophistication we have these days when it comes to reliability analysis.
Well, and I, when you said the types of questions we get, one of the questions, if I had to do a Pareto of the types of questions we get, sample size ranks right up there. And that's not a simple question. Or how do I set up an accelerated test? Right. Well, what's your failure mechanism? Let's back up again. Yet what we see in the site statistics, and I was just commenting to Chris about this and chatting about it a little bit, is stuff like how to the eight steps to create a X bar and R chart or X bar and S chart for using standard deviation instead of range. One of the most recent ones, it's been over the last month or so, it really rocketed to the top of popularity on the site, was how to calculate a mean and confidence interval. You know, how to calculate the average of a set of data or a sample and create a confidence bound around it or a confidence interval around it using the standard student T distribution. And it's getting like 4,000, 3,500, 4,000 hits per month now. And that's a lot for the site. And if I look at the, say, the top 5, 10, 20 articles on the site that get by traffic, which isn't always the right measure, I would suppose, but it's an indicator of what people are looking for. There are 10 steps to do an FMEA. You know, it's the how to create a control chart. What's the mean, median, and mode? The range rule. If you've got nothing else and you just have a handful of data, how do you use the range of your small set of data to estimate a standard deviation? You know, and it just, some of them, like Sturgis rule. I had no idea. An article about some guy that came up with a way to figure out how big to make the bins in your in histogram would be so popular. I had no idea. You know, and we in the podcast, like our last episode, we're talking about confidence and the difference between the natural language definition of that of trust and belief and stuff like that versus the statistical confidence, which is a more nuanced concept that we all have to deal with as we work with other people and getting programs developed. Yet, I have a firm belief that the reason that we're getting, I have a lot of confidence to use our last episode's discussion, that the reason the basics, the articles that go into detail on one particular fundamental issue or topic, like bin width on a histogram, is that you still need to know that stuff in order to create a program or can have a meaningful discussion around data or modeling or design for reliability activities. You still need to know the fundamentals, whether it's how metals corrode, for example. You still need to know that stuff in order to build a reliability program. It's not the high zoots physics of failure modeling and what software you're using. No, software will give you a number no matter what you do, pretty much. Is it useful? You still need to understand what's going on. And I think that's why we're getting such traffic on what are essentially fundamental topics.
Yeah, and I think it also goes back to the truism that most reliability engineering questions are really simple ones. If we want reliability engineering decision making to be baked into every decision step you take as a designer, as a manufacturer, as a maintainer, and that's overwhelming when you first hear that as an idea. How can I possibly do a Weibull analysis every 3 seconds that I'm trying to work out what the internal radius of this strut needs to be? That's not the point. You need reliability engineering answers to reliability engineering questions, especially those ones that are a sort of routine, they have to be simple, and most of them are. Will this work? Will this not work? Will this, is this the right rubber I've selected for my device?
Mm-hmm.
Is this thick enough? Those are the questions which the answer to each one of those questions goes into every design decision we make or every manufacturing decision we make. And so the vast majority of reliability engineering decision making is really, really simple, basic. It's only when you it's only when you've really started to eliminate the low-hanging fruit, as we say, that you might be left with one or two failure mechanisms which are relatively sophisticated, or you need a fairly sophisticated approach to understanding. And then you break the glass and bust out the textbook and really study that one. But you know why. You know why you're investing effort into it. But you had to have answered a lot of simple questions before you get there.
So one of the things I've also run into, and this is everything you're talking about is I totally agree with Chris. Now, yet I think there's another phenomena of why we're seeing the fundamentals or basics being popular on the site in topics that we talk about is it's embarrassing to go to your boss and saying, how do I calculate a mean?
True. Good point.
Right. So Google has allowed us in Google and is a generic now, little g, Googling something, looking something up, whether it's online or on, in a textbook, or heaven forbid, go to the library. Do those still exist? I think they do. is that nobody else needs to know I'm looking for this. And I want to double check, am I doing this right? Is this an application where I use a student T distribution, or should I be using chi-squared? What's the right way to do this one? And it's a few seconds, you look it up. Hopefully the site loads quickly, and I'm working on that. And you get an answer. You can double check something very fast. Or you could say, well, what's the process for doing this? What are the I got to explain somebody in the next meeting what's FMEA and what are the steps for it. Let me look it up. All right, I'll print that real quick and hand it to them. You know, send them the link. So I think there's some of that phenomena that having information readily available means you don't have to memorize it or know it by heart. There's no way I'm going to remember the formula of the PDF or CDF formula for the student T distribution. I don't remember the one for, I used to be in awe of people that could write down, you know, the binomial distribution from heart. I can't, I just have always just had the book available, or now I have it online. So I think there's some of that phenomena. It's becoming the site has this stuff so that when somebody's looking for it, it's ready for them to have a quick reference to it and look at it. So I think there's some of that going on too. Yet I think there's a phenomena that goes, well, I need to know that I have it right, and so I'll look it up. And I think that's the key point, is there's people that recognize that they do need to know the foundational basis or the fundamentals or the basics in order to explain it or to do the analysis correctly or go to the next step. And then inform the design teams or work with other folks. So I think there's a good piece that's related in there of some of these numbers.
True. And yeah, I mean, the stuff I teach in my courses, I mean, 3 weeks later, I'm going to have to go back and bust that equation out. I don't have that committed to memory. It's more important to know that I need to use the binomial in this to solve this problem versus, or what is a binomial distribution equation?
Right.
But yeah, I think you actually raise a good point. People might feel embarrassed going and speaking to other people. How do you calculate the MTBF?
Oh, geez, I hope they don't do that. You should know by now that you don't need to know how to calculate the MTBF or estimate it or anything else and have a meaningful result. If you have a sample of like inner diameters for a set of bearings and you want to, what's the average and what's the range of values that I'm going to use? Yeah, go look that up if you need to, you know, bust out. One of the things I've run into people, there's an article on there that says, does your calculator calculate the population standard deviation or the sample standard deviation? For a while, that was a very popular unit until calculators, by and large now, if you calculate standard deviation, it gives you both answers.
Yeah.
So anyway, but, I digress.
I mean, sometimes you need to calculate the mean to inform something else. I mean, if you want to find the mean of a normal distribution, I think what you're talking about is you don't want to use the mean and therefore base all decision making on that mean. But there are plenty of scenarios where you need to find the mean of something as part of a bigger analysis remit.
Right.
But I also think that I think you talked about point estimates and confidence intervals. And I think one of the questions you may have mentioned that we get asked semi-regularly is how confident can I be that that point estimate's right?
Yeah.
And that's not a question you can answer because you either have a point estimate or an interval within which you think that number's going to lie.
The population value would, if you have a sample and you calculate the average, it is a guess from a sample of what the population is about. And so if you're only interested in what your sample's mean is, well, it's only as good as your measurement error at that point. Right. But if it's an estimate for what's my future population, well, that's a bit fuzzier.
Yeah.
There's all kinds of factors that influence that.
There's no such thing as a certain percentage or probability that that point estimate is right. You have to go straight to intervals. And so there's some fundamentals that need to be part of your question asking as well. I think, again, so many decisions are based on basic answers to basic questions. And if you try and make things too complicated, then reliability engineering is just not going to happen.
Well, part of it, I mean, what we do in reliability, and one of the, it's one I ran into years and years ago, is a basic idea of a design guideline. I mean, it was like when you were talking about, is this seal going to hold? Well, part of the basic answer, I mean, asking the question is pretty simple. In some cases, it's very difficult to answer. Yet if that's a seal and a type of application, amount of pressure and types of materials that your organization's familiar with, well, capture that information saying, if you do X, Y, and Z type dimensions and this kind of fitting and this kind of stuff, we have evidence that that just works. If you're increasing pressure, then you need to consider these four factors to change something. But two paragraphs, a simple table in a document that says, or an online document, for example, that design engineer can go, I know enough to ask that question. And I've got an easy access to a guideline that says, oh, here's our best practices. Here's our guidance. Here's our organizational knowledge on that. And that's internal and reinforced internally if you've built that into the program. If that's not available, then you go outside the company, going to engineering journals or to documents or other places where there is a simple set of advice that allows you to inform your decision. Yeah, it's good enough. Safety factors, margin analysis, those kinds of things. Well, how much is enough? You know, is this program driven by cost, or are we driven by weight, or are we driven by time to market? You know, what's the driving factors here to make this decision? If that information is not available, Ascendo is not going to answer it for you. Yet, if you need to know how to calculate an average with a confidence interval around it, yeah, we got that article, as many people are finding.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it extends this. We can only go so far because we don't know what your application is, right?
Yeah.
But they're still calculating averages or calculating confidence intervals, calculating sample sizes, creating a histogram that has meaningful information relayed by it. Those are basics. Recently, I worked on a series of articles that were the seven basic or seven fundamental quality tools, or I don't know. It was based on an article from years ago, based on the movie The Seven Samurai, or something like that. And so they came up with the histogram, a flow chart, and so on. There was a handful of very foundational tools, and it turns out we don't agree what the seven are. So there's actually like 9 or 10 that people have considered part of the basic seven. And of course there's an advanced seven, you know, doing design of experiments and all kinds of other weird stuff. Yet that series of articles tend to do really, really well. I think a third factor that fits into this of being that you need to know these things and we don't need to memorize them is that they're not taught in engineering schools. In basic statistics, I've heard rumor in a number of top universities don't include a class on stats and probability in undergrad anymore. It was such a popular course. I don't know why they would get rid of it.
But the thing is with universities, it's not like they're tailoring degrees based on what the students take to life. It was just there's no overarching strategy. It's just you do have a bunch of you know, pretty intelligent professors and things like that, but they have their own motivations, and some of them don't even want to teach at all. Some are forced quite literally at gunpoint to go into that room and talk about something. They're there to do other stuff. Mm-hmm. And there's no degrees are essentially a collection of different courses that professors are willing to teach at, and usually they focus on their interests first and foremost. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, that can come off, but it's not a surefire thing that you'll have a beautiful progression of learning objectives when you do a degree. It's not like that. Yeah. And that's not going to change anytime soon. It's just such an entrenched culture in academia, which I think is one of the reasons academia is becoming less and less valuable. You look at Apple, for example. They have to retrain university graduates how to code when they graduate the degree in software engineering.
Well, yeah. Well, Google does the same. They're also using techniques that the universities don't know how to teach. You know, and they're using internal processes and materials and concepts and modules and so on. And it's the same with material science and all kinds of these other ones that. The other part I see in academia, and I got this from one of the professors, and Carl's been approached with the FMEA stuff, for example. It's an engineering class on product development and thinking through, just brainstorming, how would it not work? And then prioritizing that. It's a natural tool for FMEA. And so this one professor is saying, Carl, can I extract articles from your writing and make that a lesson? And force encourage my team to at least know what FMEA is and not be afraid of it and understand what its utility is and all those kind of things. And so she was actually trying to reinforce it.
Awesome.
I had another professor that I saw at a conference, and she's another woman out of Ohio someplace, that said, I've extracted like 10 of your articles about MTBF just to give the students, my engineering students, some way to rationalize how they can understand or not trust data sheets. It's like, it's brilliant. There's nothing else there out there like it. But it's so vital that you need to understand what FIT means or MTBF, mm-hmm. MTTF means, and so, stuff like that. But So part of it is the curriculum. Part of it is what they want to teach. Part of it is getting into deep understanding of some esoteric target process or whatever so that you have the ability to go learn and ask the right sequence of questions. And I've often heard that argument. Yet, if I don't know how to calculate an average versus a median or when one's appropriate versus the other, I've taught classes. It was a class I taught and the folks didn't know the difference between mean and median. That, you know, like you're college educated, working professionals, and part of your job is statistics, and you don't know this? Oh, no, we have computers to do all this stuff, and we just do the procedure and turn the crank. Okay. There goes the afternoon. Let's start with the basics here.
Well then a monkey could do that job. If you crank the crankshaft on a computer, let's not kid ourselves. There's absolutely no value in the person putting that information in having, you know, a degree.
I kind of said that to him, and I kind of don't teach that class anymore for that organization, which is fine with me.
But again, it comes back to you with the professors. I think we're going down a rabbit warren a little bit, but professors do. I mean, they teach what interests them, and that can be sometimes the more sophisticated stuff, the stuff that they find more interesting. And they can go, you know, straight from zero to a million when it comes to probability and statistics. And getting a professor to teach the basics of an MTBF and what it is and what it's not. And they essentially, in the way I like teaching it, say if you get a bell curve or any sort of probability density curve, if you can turn that into that shape, that bell curve shape, turn it into a 3D material, and then try and find its balance point. Just balance it like a teeter totter or a seesaw. Mm-hmm. That balance point is quite literally all the MTBF or all the mean is.
Yeah, the center of mass.
That's it.
Yeah,
the center of mass. So what does that mean? How does that help you make a decision?
That's right. You have an infinite number of ways to achieve that. So
yeah.
What does that really mean?
And then you pull out another probability density curve, which is a very different shape, and say, look, this has exactly the same balance point as the first one. What does that tell you?
Yeah.
The reality is the MTBF is quite literally that hypothetical balance point that your density curve, your bell curve, whatever it is that's describing your uncertainty would hypothetically balance on if it was turned into a three-dimensional shape.
Yeah.
What does that mean in terms of quarterly profit?
Yeah, not a whole lot. The idea, though, is that, I'm glad that people are finding the information they're looking for on the site. There's that. It makes me wonder what other gaps of basics and fundamentals that we should be writing about and putting up there. And the other part is there's also the basic set of concepts of, well, should I be using a chi-squared or a binomial here? You know, kind of discussion. There's another set of fundamental, what's the awareness level that you need to have in order to pull out the right set of tools? I think that's another level to it. And I don't know that we talk about that enough or put it on the site enough. And then there's the cultural parts and, you know, the upper end of the whole spectrum. And how do you put all this together to create a program or a culture or a plan or whatever? But I did see an article years ago about writing a blog, and it was recommending 80% of the articles and topics should be basics or building blocks or fundamentals, and 20% should be on the more advanced topics, to use that advanced more loosely, but more complicated topics. And I'm finding that is what people are looking for, mm-hmm. which is encouraging because we do have a lot of basic content on the site, which is there for people to learn, to fill in the gaps of what they know and don't know. So whatever the rationale or why you're looking for stuff on the site, I'd be curious, you know, Chris, you know, if somebody, you know, sent us a note or a message or gave us a voicemail on our widget, you know, how does having the basics of reliability engineering or quality or safety or these other topics that are related, how does that help you? What's working or what's missing? What are you looking for that we haven't talked about yet? I'm not going to ask why you're looking for it. I have some theories about it, but if you're looking for it, I'm glad to help find that information and make it available to you. So let us know. Head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. You can leave a voice message. You can leave a written message. You can find Chris and I and the other hosts on LinkedIn or on our about pages on the site. Lots of ways for you to get in touch with us. But the fundamental idea here is the site is meant to be, and this podcast is part of it, is to be professional development. And part of that is understanding what you need and getting to it. And so what people are finding the site useful for, and we get a lot of traffic on, is one measure, it's not the only measure, is on basics and fundamentals and simple procedures, easy, you know, descriptions of building blocks of tools. There's an article on there about how to do brainstorming, and it gets reasonable amounts of traffic. Stuff like that may or may not have been taught in your organization or in your formal education. And so it's to some degree filling that gap. But what are you looking for? What level are you most interested in getting more information about? And I guess that should actually be a survey I should do someday. But anyway, yeah, it was interesting, Chris. I should, you know, have you take a look at some of those, the Google Analytics are very insightful about what people are finding and looking for and how long they stay on stuff. It's kind of cool how we can get a sense in aggregate of what's happening on the site.
We're always trying to find the right balance between being too simple versus too sophisticated versus helpful. So it's always good to understand what people are looking for and how we can be better help, how we can help more.
Yeah, exactly. All right, Chris, thanks much for, you know, exploring this little nuance I noticed in our stats, in our analytics, I should say. But yeah, I just find it curious and it's worth talking about a little bit.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, talk to you soon, Chris. Have a good rest of your day.
You too, Fred. Talk soon.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.